Good afternoon. I will call this meeting of the Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee to order. We do have a quorum present. Members, the first order of business today will be approval of the minutes from March 3rd, 2026. Do I have a motion? Oh, Representative Lee will move approval of the March 3rd minutes. Members, any discussion or questions? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion approves. Motion is approved, and the minutes are approved. So first on our agenda today, members, we are going to receive a presentation from the Department of Children, Youth, and Families based on the February 2026 forecast. And I will kick it off to our department folks. Ms. Reisenauer, if you'd like to introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. I'm Ashley Reisenauer. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. And I'm joined by Marina Valeria, Budget Director for the DCYF. So thank you for having us. Today we'll be giving an update on forecasted programs operated by DCYF. Since the agency hasn't presented an overview of changes in the November forecast, I'll just briefly go over forecast changes from November, but most of the changes will really focus on spending trends in the current February forecast. So the Department of Children, Youth, and Families operates five forecasted programs, and I'll talk more about each of these programs in the following slides. But these are all state entitlement programs in which spending is based on state statute determining eligibility and benefit levels. Spending projections are updated twice per year in November and February, and then appropriations are based on that forecast. The changes in the November forecast are compared to projections from the end of session. So those end of session projections incorporated any legislative changes from 2025. So that leaves the big factors that inform changes in the November forecast are really updated data on spending and enrollment and updated information about policy changes and implementation. The percentage change in general fund spending across DCYF programs was relatively small in November forecast. In the 26-27 biennium, there was a decrease of $20.5 million or -2.6%. And in the 28-29 biennium, an increase of $7.8 million or 0.8%. The three changes are the result of three primary drivers. One, in the MFIT program, a greater share of people are projected to receive state-funded food benefits instead of federally funded benefits as a result of some federal policy changes that I'll talk more about in the February forecast trends. Two, decreases in the child care assistance program were driven by lower than projected caseloads and some higher than projected carry forward of federal funding. However, in the February forecast, that carry forward projection is slightly reduced. And then three, increases in North Star care for children were the result of higher than projected average payments and a shift in services from legacy programs with a local share to programs like kinship and adoption assistance that have a higher relative state share. So that's very high level overview, but we wanted to just give a starting spot to talk about the current February forecast. More background on our November forecast is always available out on our website. So that brings us to the updates and trends in the current February forecast. So this slide shows projected state general fund spending for each of these programs in the February forecast and the change from since November. In the February forecast, spending decreased by $37.9 million across the entire forecast horizon. Like the November forecast, the percentage change in general fund spending across all of these programs is less than 3% per biennium. So the net change in the 26-27 biennium is a decrease of $14.1 million, or 1.9%. And the net change in the 28-29 biennium is a decrease of $23.8 million, or 2.5%. The first program we'll talk about is the Minnesota Family Investment Program, or MFIP, which provides cash and food assistance for low-income families with children. It serves an average of nearly 63,000 people each month. During the forecast horizon, state general fund spending is projected to increase from $99 million in fiscal year 26 up to $132 million in fiscal year 29. Compared to the November forecast, projected general fund spending on this program is $16.8 million lower, or 7.3%, in the 26-27 biennium, and $9.3 million lower, or 3.5%, in the 28-29 biennium. The change is primarily driven by two things. The MFIP forecast accounts for a change in the mix of state versus federally funded food benefits for some people as a result of federal policy changes. The February forecast incorporates updated information about implementation timelines, which will be more gradual than assumed in the November forecast. Updated data also showed average monthly benefit amounts were somewhat lower than expected, so future benefit growth is just projected off of a lower base. The next program is the Child Care Assistance Program, which provides child care assistance to MFIP families who are employed or engaged in other work activities or education as part of their MFIP employment plan. The program also provides transition year child care assistance to former MFIP families and serves an average of 4,900 families each month. During the forecast horizon, state general fund spending is projected to increase from $74 million in fiscal year 26 to $165 million in fiscal year 29. Compared to the November forecast, the projected general fund spending on this program is $6 million, or 3.2% higher than in the 26-27 biennium, and $12.2 million lower, or 3.8% in the 28-29 biennium. The change in the first biennium is driven by an increase in the number of families projected to be served and a small reduction in the amount of federal funding carried forward from fiscal year 25 into fiscal year 26. In the second biennium, average payments are expected to grow somewhat more slowly than previously projected, resulting in a decrease relative to the November forecast. North Star Care for Children is a program that's designed to help children who are removed from their homes and placed in foster care. It supports permanency through adoption or transfer of custody to a relative if the child cannot be safely reunited with parents. Financial support is provided to adoptive and foster parents to encourage permanent placement of children in safe homes. In fiscal year 25, North Star served about 18,300 children each month. During this forecast horizon, state general fund spending is projected to increase from $121 million in fiscal year 26 to $142 million in fiscal year 29. Compared to the November forecast, projected general fund spending on this program is $1.7 million, or 0.7% lower, in the 26-27 biennium, and $1.5 million, or 0.6% higher, in the 28-29 biennium. The changes in the first biennium reflect lower than anticipated growth in participation, and those are partially offset in the second biennium by an increase in projected average payments and the number of children receiving kinship assistance. The Early Childhood Family Education Program is a program that transferred from the Department of Education to DCYF and is a community education program for children birthed through kindergarten, their parents, and parents who are expecting children. This also includes the Home Visiting ECFE program, and the program is supported with a combination of population-based equalized levy funds as well as state general funds. During the forecast horizon, state general fund spending is projected to increase from $39 million in fiscal year 26 to $43 million in fiscal year 29. And compared to the November forecast, the projected general fund spending on the program is $1.6 million lower, or 1.9%, in 26-27, and $37 million, or 4.2% lower, in 28-29 biennium. The changes are primarily driven by a reduction in the estimates of eligible children just based on updated school census data. Our last program is the Early Childhood Health and Developmental Screening Program. This is also a program that transferred from the Department of Education to DCYF, and it helps caregivers detect factors that may impede children's learning, growth, and development. So school districts use screenings to link families with health and early learning opportunities and resources, which includes things like Head Start, early childhood family education, pre-kindergarten programs, early childhood special education, and more. During the forecast horizon, state general fund spending is projected to remain and continue remaining stable at $4 million per year. Compared to the November forecast, the change in general fund spending was relatively small at less than $100,000 in each biennium. And again, the changes were driven primarily by lower than expected participation in 2026 of younger children who are generally paid at slightly higher rates. More information is also about the February forecast is also always available out on our website, and we did, I believe, provide the executive summary, which also has a lot of great information about the forecast. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Reisenauer. Members, we will move to questions about the February forecast update, if there are any. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was paying attention to the whole thing. But you in North Star, you noted. I think this is one of those interesting indicators from a trend thing. You noted that it was 18,000 kids. What percent? Can you give me a better understanding on population growth as it corresponds to spending? Like, let's just do North Star Care, for example. You noted there was 18,000, kids per month. Is that growing?
Ms. Risenauer.
Chair, yes, thank you. It is projected to grow over time. In fact, the program is growing as a whole by about 11.2% in that biennium. And I can give you a few more details about how that changes. So in fiscal year 26, we're projecting to spend about 18,400 people, so slightly higher. And by 2029, projecting to spend about 19,200 people per month.
Representative Doe.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. There's so many related and corresponding costs when we're moving kids from families that ultimately serve here. I mean, is there something that we should be thinking about? That's a trend line that I think is super unfortunate. Do you see that there's anything that we can do at the agency and the legislature that could, that could really focus on reducing that growth?
Go right ahead, Ms. Risenauer.
Thanks. I'm not sure I can comment on policy changes to consider, but I will note that we are seeing a shift in the types of services that are being used within North Star and seeing a heavier use seeing that some of the pieces like kinship assistance are growing at a faster proportionate rate than some of the other programs like foster care that are also included in the North Star program.
Representative Nadeau?
One final question. And so if we're increasing kinship, is that a cost center that we track, or do our counties picking up most of that? How are we tracking the costs related to increased kinship?
Ms. Risenauer.
Thanks. So we do break out both in the forecast and look at the relative growth in kinship assistance relative to other pieces like foster care. We also see adoption assistance as well and track that, and we can get you those details as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Certainly. All right. Co-Chair West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question on the child care assistance graphs. So I believe when we see the graphs without any state share, are those federal funds from the American Rescue Plan that eliminate that? If I'm right, you can just nod. If I'm wrong, please inform me.
Ms. Risenauer.
I'm sorry. I couldn't hear the full question. Could you repeat it?
Co-Chair West.
On the child care assistance page where we see elimination of the state share of funds, is that from it being picked up by federal legislation?
Ms. Risenauer.
The February forecast assumes current federal share and current federal awards, and we assume that those will stay steady as we've seen for the past few years.
Co-Chair West.
Looking at the federal share on the later years of the forecast, it shows that staying relatively steady. Looking at the other years, at least in the graph, the years this covers, they seem to generally increase. Has there been a stretch in maybe the last 20 years where the federal share does do something like stay within 2 million and decline? Or has it generally increased as it shows in the more recent years?
Ms. Risenauer.
So I think when you're looking at the graph, you'll see during COVID, the state received some one-time additional funds for child care assistance, and those were temporary, and they've continued to roll forward and inform the federal share. Going forward, we've assumed it'll stay fairly steady, and we can get you more information about, like, historical data, if that's what you're asking for, on the federal share, too.
Mm-hmm. Co-Chair West?
Yeah, just before this, to inform the committee on what the federal government has generally done related to it, I think would be valuable information when thinking long-term.
Any further questions, members? Okay. Yes, I have a question. back to the North Star Care for Children, actually. And I know that Representative Nadeau was asking a couple questions about this and just kind of the trend in number of children and families served through this type of programming. And you said that there's a breakout, and it's between kinship care, active out-of-home placement or foster care, and then adoption assistance. Are those the three main programs that kind of fall under this this North Star Care for Children, Ms. Reisenauer?
Yeah, those are the three. There's a small amount of legacy programs, but it's very, very small. I think so small that we actually need to mask the data for data privacy purposes in the forecast.
Okay, thank you so much. And I guess I'm thinking, Representative Nadeau, of our work in the MAFPA space and how encouraging families to move through like the kinship process you know, how that may impact spending in this area. But I think it's definitely something that we want to keep an eye on. We know oftentimes that families who step up into kinship placements are oftentimes extended family, maybe aging extended family, and who don't have who haven't planned on having the financial burden, some may say, of caring for children in their later years. So I think that that's definitely something we want to kind of just keep an eye on, but making sure that there are funds to support those families so that kids can stay within their extended family situation. Representative Hicks.
Sorry, I'm a little disorganized today. Thank you so much for the presentation. I'm always fascinated by forecasts because I always feel like the state does a really good job of being the most ancient or anxious millennial I've ever seen, where every program is like forecasted to spend way more than it actually does, and savings are always very conservative, and I appreciate that as a legislator. It's not a dig. It's very helpful when we're doing budgeting, frankly. But I just wanted to talk a little bit about NFIP and ask a couple of follow-up questions because both of those things have seen a significant decrease. And you separated NFIP investment program from child care assistance, but the child care assistance on the second page, is that only for NFIP families or is that all child care assistance? And then is the NFIP on this side including infant child care, housing support, like all of the pieces that are part of NFIP versus just the cash portion?
Ms. Reisenauer.
Thanks. So the piece that you see on the slide represents the cash and food assistance that's paid through MFIP. On the next slide that shows the child care assistance program, this is child care assistance for current MFIP families with some of the transition year MFIP families as well.
Okay, great.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. And so this is a question that I've had and I haven't had a chance to ask you, so I apologize. So since food support is rolled into NFIP, in this scenario, but we have SNAP federal changes. How do those SNAP federal changes impact the food portion of NFIP, or do they not at all?
Ms. Reisenauer.
Yeah, thanks. So the federal food portion of MFIP is paid through SNAP. So it is SNAP benefits for people who are enrolled in MFIP. There are some changes, as I mentioned, that there were federal policy changes that some people will not be eligible for federal benefits as a result of HR1, but they are eligible for state-funded food benefits under MFIP. So that's incorporated into the forecast.
Representative Hicks.
Do you happen to know how many families that is?
Ms. Reisenauer.
By 2029, we're projecting about 3,000 people. So it moves from currently state-funded food is about 1%, and it moves to about 6%. So,
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. I really appreciate that clarification because I was sort of wondering how those things would interplay as the criteria are different. NFIP or PORAS is probably a Ms. Summerfield question because I'm wondering about the same interactions with reporting requirements with NFIP compared to HR1 and just sort of wanting to get a sense of how those things will play in, and particularly around this piece.
Ms. Reisenauer.
Do you happen to know? I can ask Ms. Summerfield later, too.
I would have to check on the reporting requirements in particular.
Okay. Thank you. I really, really appreciate that. I think it's important to, we're going to have to make some changes to have things align because right now they really don't. And I think, you know, hearing how that's going to impact the state share of food is just another example of that. So I really, really appreciate that information. Thank you.
All right. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you go back to the MFIP slide for a moment? And I'm hoping my almost 40-year-old eyes will help me see what I need to see. Okay, that's what I thought. So it looks to me, in starting in forecast year 2028, that this non-federal share appears. Can you explain that? And specifically, what is the non-federal share? Where does that money come from?
Ms. Reisenauer.
Yeah, thank you. So as we mentioned, a portion of the federal funds in the MFIP forecast are SNAP related. Under HR 1, there is a non-federal share based on the payment error rate for SNAP payments. That piece represents that non-federal share that will be incurred for SNAP benefits for MFIP participants.
Representative Coulter.
Okay, thank you. So that represents the error rate payments. So I guess I'm just curious why, because that would in theory come from the state. So I'm curious why that was delineated outside of the state share.
Ms. Reisenauer.
Sure, there isn't. So this is part of the overall SNAP SNAP program. There isn't currently a state appropriation for that program. So there's an authorization point. So it's strictly shown here as a non-federal share to recognize it without attributing it to one place or the other.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you. That's actually very, very helpful. Thank you.
All right. Members, any further questions for our DCF guests, DCYF guests today? Okay. Seeing none, we'll look forward to some of that additional historical information that Co-Chair Weston asked for, and maybe a little bit more of the breakdown of that North Star assistance for children. And that'll be helpful in our decisions going forward. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
All right. Members, we do have a bill up today from Representative Sensenmura. She is presenting a bill in another committee at this point in time. But as you can see, we have a very long list of testifiers signed up from the public to speak. So I think in the interest of time, it makes sense to start testimony while we await Representative Sensenmura. So I will...
Madam Chair?
Representative Olson.
I would request that another member of this committee potentially move the bill because it would be impossible to have a hearing or have testimony on a bill that we're not currently have before us. So in the parliamentary procedure behind this, if one of your members would possibly take the seat, move the bill, then we can provide testimony, we can listen to it. That would be the appropriate way of doing this.
Right. Thank you for that. Representative Perez Vega, would you be so kind as to move House File 3415 before the committee?
Go right ahead.
Thank you. So, Representative Perez Vega will move that House File 3415 be re-referred to the General Register. And we're and Representative Perez Vega, there is a DE1 amendment. Do you feel prepared to move the DE1 amendment?
Out of respect of my colleague, I do. I would like to ask to move the DE1 amendment.
Okay. In the absence of Representative Sensenmura, Representative Perez Vega will move the DE1 amendment, but perhaps we can have House Fiscal walk us through the content of the DE1. Ms. Fallone, or House Research, excuse me. Representative Nadeau, question.
Just to clarify, I've got two DE1s.
I just want to make sure, are we in the Spencer-Mura DE1 or the Paris-Vega DE1? I'm sorry.
The Paris-Vega, sorry, Madam Chair. The Paris-Vega is an A2 amendment, I believe.
Representative Paris-Vega has an amendment to the DE1.
That's right.
So,
just gotta move this one first.
Thank you.
So, first so up is the.
We're on the DE1.
Correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Amendment to the DE1.
We are on the A2 amendment to the DE1.
No.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
You gotta. Madam Chair, we got
Representative Perez Vega.
We got to move the DE one more, and then we get to go to my amendment.
Yes. Thank you.
There you go.
Well, yeah. You know, we say that it takes a village to raise a child, but it also takes a village to run a committee.
Absolutely.
So, to the DE one amendment, Ms. Fallone Day, if you would walk us through.
Chair, members. The DE1 subdivision 1 provides definitions of a child care center and employee judicial officer that are used in the following subdivisions of the bill. Excuse me. Subdivision 2, the bill prohibits employees of child care centers from consenting to a federal, state, or local official entering a child care center for the purposes of civil immigration enforcement without a warrant signed by a judicial officer that authorizes the arrest of a particular individual. Additionally, the employee must request that the federal, state, or local official provide identification and a written statement of purpose. If the federal, state, or local official enters a child care center, the employee must immediately notify the child care license holder or authorized agent. And the last paragraph, paragraph C on page 2, explicitly does not prohibit entry by a state, federal, or local official administering to a state or federally supported child care program.
Thank you. Representative Sensenmura, House Research just walked us through the DE1 amendment.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else that you'd like to add when it comes to the DE1? Okay. Right. Members, we are going to take a vote on adoption of the author's DE1 amendment to get the bill into the shape that the author would like. All those in favor? Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to speak on the DE1 briefly prior to the vote on it. So the underlying bill really was nonsensical because it put conditions on judicial warrants that were entirely unlawful. And it seems the goal is to demonstrate the difference between judicial warrants and admin warrants. That has been a cause of public debate. The DE1 resolves those issues, and it is an author's amendment. So I'd urge members to support the DE1 amendment.
Thank you, Chair West. Members, all those in favor of the DE1 author's amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Great. The motion prevails, and the DE1 amendment is adopted. Okay. All right. So, Representative Sensenmura, we were prepared to start taking testimony in your absence, but if you would like to issue any opening words prior to Representative Perez Vega, we are going to move to testimony and then take the amendment toward the end, if that's all right. So, Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Co-Chair West, and committee members. Yesterday in this committee, we started an important conversation about the real fear that has been a part of our child care centers in the last few months. And so this bill continues that conversation today. We're going to be joined by educators and parents who are going to talk to the real terror that they and their families and their children and the workers of these child care centers have felt since Operation Metro Surge started, and ICE agents have been circling child care centers, waiting outside for workers, making it so that people cannot get the child care that they need safely. We talk so much in this committee about all the barriers to childcare, right? There are barriers around making sure that there is high quality and safety within a childcare center. There are so many barriers in opening and maintaining a childcare center. There are so many barriers in being able to pay for childcare or to be able to make a living wage at a childcare center. The last thing that we need is masked men who do not identify themselves terrorizing families outside childcare centers. And that's what exactly what has happened in the last few months. This bill is simple. It would say that ICE agents or anyone conducting immigration enforcement cannot come into a child care center without a judicial warrant. Previous to the second Trump administration, there had been a federal policy that ICE agents did not go to sensitive or sacred spaces. That included hospitals, schools, and it also included child care centers. Because previous to this administration, we had some baseline, I think, sense of shared understanding that the places where our youngest learners go have to be safe. They have to be safe from this kind of immigration enforcement, especially the kind of lawless enforcement that we have seen in the Twin Cities in the last couple months. Yesterday during the bill hearing that we had, I wrote down a quote from Representative Hudson. He said, if you want to bring a bill for life-altering consequences for people that would terrorize daycare centers, I'm all for it. So Representative Hudson was interested in bringing bills around consequences for people that would terrorize daycare centers. This is not that bill. This bill simply says, don't come to a daycare center and terrorize. Let's be proactive about this. Let's say that these are not places for immigration enforcement. These are places for safety and learning. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sensenmura. Members, we are seeking the laminated copy of the conduct rules of the committee room that I would like to read before we begin, but we don't have a copy. We have an electronic copy. Very good. It's typically here sitting on the desk, and it's so. We have a lot of testifiers in the room today. Some may be new to the Capitol space, but want to make sure that we are all on the same page when it comes to conduct here in the room. We have Sergeant-at-Arms staff who are wearing gold yellow ties. They will be present in House committee hearings, and each hearing will be ticketed. They will provide overflow options when the room is filled, conduct behavioral analysis of individuals entering and leaving the rooms, and address or, if necessary, refer any accommodation requests. Access behind the committee testifiers and representative table will also be limited. We have this. Okay. The committee chair will maintain control of these proceedings and will establish the following expectations. Signs and placards are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause or other audible demonstrations are not allowed. For safety reasons, standing or sitting in walkways and aisles or standing or obstructing at your chair is prohibited. If you require any accommodation, please speak with our Sergeant-at-Arms staff. Troopers and House security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. Those providing testimony will be given specific time limits, which must be strictly observed. And if you've received an entrance ticket, please retain it as it may be required for re-entry if you leave the hearing room. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in the removal from the hearing room. Our goal is to conduct these proceedings efficiently while ensuring everyone the opportunity to observe and participate appropriately. Thank you for your cooperation and participation in our legislative process. So today, testifiers, we have a two-minute time frame, and we will be having a timer go off. And if you are not finished with your testimony, then I will gently remind you to wrap up your testimony at that time. First on the list, we have Pastor Sergio Amazuka, followed by Pastor Miriam Samuelson Roberts. You can approach the testifiers table. Pastor Miriam is unable to join us, so Pastor Sergio will be followed by Alexandra Fitzsimmons, if you'd like to approach the testifiers table. And Pastor, when you are set, you may introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Sergio Amezcua. I'm a pastor in Minneapolis. So first of all, I want to thank you, Madam Chair, and the members of the committee for listening to us during these times. So I'm a leader with Unidos Minnesota, and I serve as a pastor in DHA Church in Minneapolis, and I'm also the director of DHH Operations, which we support thousands of families across the Twin Cities each week. So thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of the bill, HF 3415. In a word, we see every day the families try when children feel safe in places that mean to care for them. Child care centers that seek to protect, educate, and nurture children. They should be spaces where kids can learn and grow without fear and disruption. HF 3415 helps reinforce that. This bill does not interfere with lawful federal enforcement. It simply sets a clear, reasonable, and standard when agents seek access to child care facilities, requiring a valid identification, state purpose, and judicial warrant. These safeguards help us ensure that children's environments remain stable while still respecting the law. Children in these settings are among the most vulnerable in our communities. They cannot advocate for themselves, and it's our responsibility to make sure that these spaces remain safe and focus in their well-being. Minnesota has a long value of family stability, child safety, and responsibility governance. HF 3415 reflects those values by putting common sense protections in place. As a pastor and a community leader, I see how families are working to build better futures for their children. Policies like this help create those secure, predictable environments kids need to thrive. So I respectfully urge you to support the bill HF 3415. Thank you for your time and for your service.
Thank you, Pastor. Next we have, you may return to your seat. next we have Alexandra Fitzsimmons, followed by Anna Lander. Do you want to approach the testifiers table? Ms. Fitzsimmons, introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Katiza Watun and members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Senior Policy Director with Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. Thank you for hearing Representative Censor Mira's child well-being bill today, House File 3415, which helps to ensure child care spaces are safe from immigration enforcement activity. At its core, this bill is about whether the spaces designed for the care and development of Minnesota's youngest children remain safe and stable environments. In Minnesota, one in five children has at least one parent who is an immigrant, and the vast majority of these Minnesota children are U.S. citizens. Policies affecting immigrant families directly affect many Minnesota children. In many toddler classrooms, children keep a small stuffed animal or a well-loved blanket in their cubby, much like this one. Young children rely on comfort, routine, and trusted adults to feel safe enough to explore, learn, and grow. For a young child in childcare, safety is built through simple but essential experiences: a trusted caregiver, predictable routines, a classroom that feels safe, and knowing their parent or caregiver will come back at the end of the day. But when immigration enforcement agents appear in or around childcare settings, young children can sense the fear in the adults around them, even if they cannot explain what is happening. In early childhood, children rely on the reactions of trusted adults, parents, caregivers, and teachers to know whether they are safe. When the adults they depend on appear afraid, children can begin to feel unsafe too. For a toddler or a preschooler, one question can take over: will my parent or caregiver still come back for me? Research shows that even the visible threat of immigration enforcement can increase anxiety and separation distress in young children. When children fear that a parent could be detained or deported, their stress response system activates. In early childhood, when the brain is rapidly developing, repeated or intense stress can disrupt emotional regulation, sleep, and readiness to learn. Research from the Center on the Developing Child at Harvard University describes this as toxic stress, which can have long-term impacts on health and development. In January, Children's Defense Fund Minnesota filed an amicus brief in the ICE surge matter, State v. Nome, on behalf of Minnesota children, highlighting the developmental risks when enforcement actions destabilize spaces where young children should feel safest.
Ms. Fitzsimmons, if you could just wrap up.
Protecting child care settings helps ensure that young children can grow, learn, play, and feel safe in the spaces designed for their care. We respectfully urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Anna Lander, who will be followed by Alexandria Schroeder, who is a parent that has to leave early to pick up kids, so we're jumping ahead in the agenda a bit. Ms. Lander, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Anna Lander, Madam and Mr. Chair of the Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee. My name is Anna Lander. I'm a lifelong Minneapolis resident here as the parent of a child who attends a Spanish immersion daycare in the heart of South Minneapolis. I'm also a trained observer of federal immigration activity, all of which compels me to come here today and testify in support of this bill and ask you to please, please pass this bill. On January 7th at 8:30 a.m., unbeknownst to me at the time, only an hour before ICE agents murdered Renee Good, I dropped my daughter off in her pre-K classroom and noticed that our daycare center director was in the room visibly upset and crying. Through tears, she explained that a staff member from the Spanish immersion daycare just one block from ours had been taken, presumably by ICE agents, from her place of work. I say presumably because the agents carried no identification, did not show a warrant, and ripped the staff member from her car and hauled her away, all in front of parents dropping off their young children at daycare, infants. For the past 41 days, including today right now when our 3:30 p.m. shift starts, community members, parents, family, and friends have taken time away from their jobs, their home lives, their families to stand outside in frigid Minneapolis weather from 6 to 9 a.m. and 3:30 p.m. to 6 p.m. daily to ensure that our center staff, teachers, parents, and children get in and out of our center doors safely. We wear these safety vests and our whistles, ready to serve and protect our community when it feels like no one else will. My daughter's teacher stopped coming to work, too afraid to leave her home, in fear of what happened at our sister school would happen to her. My daughter adores her pre-K teacher and the emotional toll it took on her not to have her favorite adult greeting her every morning with a smile and a hug was heartbreaking. My daughter has stopped wanting to go to school. She cries every morning in the car, asking when her teacher will come back to her. She wants to know where she went, why she left, and if she's ever coming back. As a parent, I completely support ensuring that all staff employed by our child care centers are safe, loving, caring adults who abide by and uphold the law. The passing of this bill does not take away the power to ensure those protections stay in place. This bill simply demands those in positions of power do not abuse their authority and asks them to comply with simple rules that we expect from every other law enforcement agency to uphold. Identifying the agency they work for, sharing their work identification, producing legal warrants, and upholding public safety. The mantra of our school patrol group for the past 41 days has been, "We keep us safe." I ask you all humbly, please step in and do your part to keep us safe too. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Alexandria Schroeder, who will be followed by Dylan Miracle. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Alex Schroeder. I'm a St. Paul girl who lives in Minneapolis. I'm a lawyer, a wife, and a mom at Casa de Corazon, a Spanish immersion daycare. On January 11th, one of my children's teachers, Kati, and her husband were taken by ICE. We found out because another parent went to pick up Kati for work, trying to keep her safe so she wouldn't have to take the bus and risk being stopped by ICE agents. That parent called her. He knocked on her door. There was no answer. A few hours later, we learned what had happened. Since then, Kati and her husband have been transferred between facilities in Minnesota, Texas, Louisiana, and New Mexico. She is still in detention. Kati is not the worst of the worst. She's not a criminal. She has legal work authorization and passed a background check to care for our children. She is a trusted and loving teacher. Kati knows that my four-year-old daughter needs her back rubbed in order to fall asleep at nap time, and that my one-year-old son jumps up and starts dancing whenever he hears music. She was part of our children's daily lives, and she was taken from us. Since then, parents, including my husband, have taken turns standing outside of our daycare to help protect our teachers and our children. Recently, I overheard my 4-year-old daughter during a pretend phone call. Her phone was a banana. She said, "Hi, my daddy's not here. He's standing outside our school because some people want to scare the teachers." That's not something a 4-year-old should have to carry. This bill would not prevent a federal agent with a valid judicial warrant from doing their job. What it would do if passed is protect children from witnessing armed enforcement actions in their classrooms or on the playground. It would ensure due process. It would give child care providers clear standards. And it would keep immigration enforcement agents from spaces, away from spaces, where babies are stacking blocks and pre-K students are practicing their ABCs. Passing this bill would protect the basic stability that families like mine rely on every single day. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your story. Next, we have Dylan Miracle, who will be followed by Katie Brown. You can introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dylan Miracle. I am a parent of a 4-year-old who attends a South Minneapolis Spanish immersion daycare, and I am speaking in support of HF 3415. A couple of minutes is not enough to reflect on the totality of the disruption that ICE has brought to our community, so I would like to focus on specifically how dangerous proximity to ICE agents are for our children, why, as a parent, I fear for our children and their caregivers, and why it is critical to limit their access to daycares. The roads around our daycares are always a source of anxiety for parents, but ICE has shown a complete disregard for traffic laws. They are speeding in large SUVs down local streets. They are causing frequent wrecks. Additionally, ICE has shown no hesitation to spray people with mace, fill blocks with tear gas, and fire flashbangs, all of which can seriously injure or kill a child. They left kids in a car after taking the parents when it was 14 degrees out. They hold children hostage to get to their parents and caregivers. I watched agents ram a car in front of my house. Men in masks pulled a guy that works at the burger joint down the street out of his car. They stuffed him into an unmarked SUV and sped off down Lake Street. They left a dented car, and that's it. And they clearly do not care if they hurt people. They believe that they have absolute immunity. They threaten people that watch them. They murder people that oppose them in the streets. I have done observation shifts and seen these agents drive slowly past our center. Imagine knowing antisocial, violent agents were watching the building that your child was in. My 4-year-old son asked me, "Dada, why they are taking people?" And that is not a question that a 4-year-old should be asking. I'm honored to have such brave and selfless neighbors, but we need help. I hope you will stand with us. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Miracle. Next, we have Katie Brown, who will be followed by Maria Snyder. Feel free to introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Katie Brown, a parent of 2 little kids who attend a Spanish immersion daycare in South Minneapolis. On the morning of January 7th, our center's cook was abducted by armed ICE agents during morning drop-off. She was on her way to work to feed my children. Parents and young children stood outside and witnessed the kidnapping of a woman with the proper documentation to live and work in the United States. I came to school to find teachers in tears, staff members visibly distressed, a stark difference from every other morning filled with energetic music, love, and joy. At home later that evening, I asked my 4-year-old son to tell me about his day. His response was, "My teachers were very sad at school." I felt true heartbreak as I thought through how I'd explain to my son that his cook was taken from her car, taken from her peers, taken from his classmates, and most tragically, taken from her husband and daughters. As parents, we should never have to tell our kids their teachers are afraid to go outside or that they fear being kidnapped. For the past 40 days, a committed group of parents, grandparents, friends, and neighbors have kept watch over our daycare center. No matter the temperature, parents are stationed outside of each doorway starting as early as 6:30 a.m. In the evening, parents stay until the final staff member leaves. We spend our mornings and evenings driving teachers to and from work. We're stretched beyond our means to care for our own children while protecting the people who care for our kids each day. We've sacrificed our family time, and now we need your help. Members of the committee, I am asking you to make decisions that reflect the belief that every caregiver and educator deserves to live free from fear. I am asking you to fund and prioritize policies that expand safety, not restrict it. There's no reason ICE should be allowed on daycare and school property. Please join us in keeping our caregivers safe. Please pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your story, Ms. Brown. Next, we have Maria Snyder, who will be followed by John Beeler. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
I'm Maria Snyder. I'm the director of Rainbow Child Development Center in St. Paul, and I'm the vice president of the Minnesota Child Care Association. During Operation Metro Surge, every day when I was driving to work, I would grip the steering wheel, and I would try not to get distracted by all the pings on my phone, because every notification and phone call felt like a jump scare. Is today the day that one of my teachers gets abducted, a child is taken, a parent? ICE agents routinely circled my child care center, where I serve children ages 6 weeks to 6 years old, sometimes on a loop between a nearby elementary school and a special needs school. Agents would sometimes go very slowly in a convoy of blacked out vehicles, and other times go well over twice the speed limit, just zooming by with no regard for safety. They cause many car accidents. They've chased families and people into child care buildings with weapons drawn. Children have been unable to play outside at my center. We have gone on lockdown multiple times a week all throughout Operation Metro Surge. I wanted to bring the cards for you, but I forgot to grab them. The teachers came up with an idea to try to scare the children less about being in lockdown all the time. So we use little color cards. Yellow means there's a threat nearby. No one people can be here. Red means we're on complete lockdown. We use bigger signs to put in our windows so that our neighbors know when we need help. When I see the yellow vests in the audience today, I get really emotional because you are the people that have been showing up for us. Thank you. Creating spaces for children to access education is not radical. It's in accordance with international law, which declares that education is a human right. While a drawdown has been announced, I see ICE activity every day in our neighborhood. The Border Czar stated that ICE agents are staying in Minnesota to investigate fraud, something that is well outside their jurisdiction, yet another looming threat for children in childcare. We know that children right now are currently being detained in detention centers. Bills like the one being introduced today are essential legal pathways for accountability and protection. This bill can help provide clarity where there is currently confusion and fear about what rights and responsibilities childcare providers have in situations with the federal government. It can also help inform local law enforcement on how to best support and protect children in childcare. The safety of our children matters. The trauma they experience witnessing arrests, detentions, and violence negatively impacts their brain development forever. They only get to be three one time. We're responsible to protect children. This committee today has an opportunity to protect children by passing this bill. Please vote in favor. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Next, we have John Beeler, who will be followed by Anna Stallman. Please introduce yourself when you're ready and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Beeler. I'm the policy counsel at the ACLU of Minnesota, testifying in support today of HF 3415 as amended. The bill returns us to a policy that was in place for roughly 20 years, prohibiting immigration enforcement at sensitive locations, including venues where families and their children are present, like preschools and daycares. There are three means of entry into a private property for law enforcement. They can come in with a warrant, they can come in with consent, or they can come in during an emergency. This bill only strikes away that middle one, that takes away that consent. In 2007, the George W. Bush administration issued a memo to ICE restricting immigration enforcement at or near schools, other institutions of education, and venues where children and their families may be present. As prior DHS officials noted, DHS can accomplish its enforcement mission without denying or limiting individuals' access to needed medical care, children access to their schools, the displaced access to food and shelter, people of faith access to their place of worship, and more. We have seen the disastrous results of the policy change here in Minnesota once that policy was rescinded by President Trump. Daycares, we have seen that policy change on daycares and staff as their children and families are carrying undue stress and disappearing. Operation Metro Surge has put these daycare workers at risk simply on the basis of their race and ethnicity. Providers are losing staff to the ICE raids because immigrant staffers are either being arrested or choosing to stay home. Families and the providers that they are serving are also in hiding, not taking their children to school or daycare to avoid ICE. Bills protecting these sensitive locations have existed in other states for nearly a decade. When a similar bill was challenged in California, the court upheld most of the regulations from the state. Citing Supreme Court precedent, the Ninth Circuit said, a state does not discriminate against federal government and those with whom it deals unless it treats someone better than it treats them. The California law in that case did not treat the federal government worse than anyone else, and it did not regulate federal operations at all. That's what this bill does. This bill does not regulate federal, state, or local law enforcement differently. It says that if anyone is engaged in civil immigration operations, they need a judicial warrant to enter a daycare facility. Our child care workers, our families deserve the safety and security of knowing that these facilities are safe from warrantless raids. We ask this committee to support HF 3415. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Beeler. We have Anna Solomon, followed by Dr. Nicole Smirillo. If you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Anna Stallman. I am a mother, and I am asking you to protect my child by passing HF 3415. My two-year-old son goes to a Spanish immersion daycare in South Minneapolis. It is his second home. The people there are not just staff, they are family. And on January 7th, our family was torn apart. That morning, a beloved staff member, a woman, a mother, here legally with an active asylum case, was abducted. Right in front of babies and toddlers and their parents who are arriving for what was supposed to be a day of learning and love. I want you to sit with that image. Little ones excited to start their day, hands held by parents who stood in horror as masked agents in tactical gear with guns aggressively pulled a staff member out of her car and hauled her off in unmarked vehicles. And here is what makes this even more wrong. They showed no identification, and they had no warrant for her. She is here legally with an active asylum case, and they took her anyway. What happened to her was not just terrifying, it was unlawful. Nothing has been the same since. That safe, joyful place was violated in an instant. But what happened next is also something I want you to know. We showed up for each other because no one else was going to protect us. Because protections like HF 3415 haven't been codified into state law. Parents organized overnight, we held our community together with our bare hands. For 8 weeks, I have been a lead observer for our school patrol. I have shown up in this vest with this whistle Monday through Friday. I have told other parents where they are stationed, let them know what to be on the lookout for, and I have relayed ICE sightings through a rapid response chat to the observers at our school and our neighboring daycare center. And in those 8 weeks, I have personally watched confirmed ICE vehicles drive by, circle our building, photograph and film us as we stand guard outside a daycare center. I am a mother standing outside my toddler's daycare to protect him from the federal government committing more unlawful acts. That sentence should horrify you because it horrifies me. The law should be protecting our children's safe haven, not a group of parents who are supposed to be at work. So please pass this bill. HF 3415 doesn't create a new right. It enforces one that we already have. It codifies into Minnesota law that a valid judicial warrant is required before any federal agent can enter a child care facility. Minnesota has the power to protect its children. I am asking you to use it. Thank you.
Thank you for testifying today. You could introduce yourself when you're ready and proceed. You'll be followed by Mary Nicolai.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I am Dr. Nicole Smarillo, and I'm the Director of Data, Research, and Policy at Think Small. I'm here today to express Think Small's strong support for House File 3415. House File 3415 aligns directly with Think Small's mission to advance quality early care and education of children in their crucial early years by ensuring child care centers remain safe, stable, and trusted environments for children and families. Members, I will be talking a little bit about some data you'll find on this infographic on page 2 of your packet. Think Small recently conducted a survey of child care programs across the 7-county metro area to better understand the impact of recent federal immigration enforcement activities. From December 2025 to February 2026, 27% of programs who responded in the metro reported experiencing increases in child absences. 35% saw declining enrollments, 27% had to close unexpectedly for at least one day, with many stating that these impacts were directly related to immigration, customs, and enforcement activity. We also heard childcare providers tell us children have been absent because some parents don't want to drop off or pick up alone. Or, quote, we have students who are not attending and staff who do not feel safe. Not only do these disruptions threaten the sustainability of an already strained childcare system, but they also interfere with children's community of care, which we know is foundational to early learning and healthy development. Families must feel confident that childcare centers are safe spaces for their children, and providers must be able to focus on nurturing those young children. HF 3415 provides the clarity and protection that both families and providers need and safeguards children's emotional well-being and sense of security. We know that children need a stability of care. We urge you to support HF 3415, and thank you for your leadership on this issue and for your commitment to supporting young children, their families, and the early childhood workforce. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Mary Nicolai, who will be followed by David Zimmer. Please go ahead, once you're settled, introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Mary Nicolai. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis, the proud wife of a public school teacher, and a mother of two children who attend a Spanish immersion daycare in South Minneapolis. I'm here today to express my strong support for HF 3415 and legislation that would prohibit ICE agents from entering the property of a child care center. On January 7th, as I was dropping my children off at daycare, I learned that just minutes earlier, a beloved employee, who I will call Mrs. N, had been taken into custody by masked, armed ICE agents directly in front of the school. Although I did not witness the arrest firsthand, I later watched several videos recorded by members of the community. Those videos show several unmarked SUVs with flashing lights suddenly approaching and boxing in her car. Multiple armed men wearing masks and vests labeled police approached Mrs. N and demanded identification. Mrs. N does not speak English, and ironically, the very agency that detained her, the Department of Homeland Security, had previously approved her employment authorization to work in the U.S., which remains valid for another 4 years. Officers placed her in handcuffs, put her in the back of a vehicle, and drove away. This entire encounter took place directly in front of the daycare center and in front of witnesses that included her colleagues, parents dropping off their children, and young daycare students. When I entered the daycare facility that morning, the atmosphere was somber and fearful. Teachers were crying and calling their loved ones. The people I trust each day to care for my children, the people responsible for keeping them safe, had just watched their colleague and friend handcuffed, placed in an unmarked vehicle, and taken to an unknown location. The days that followed were extraordinarily stressful for our community. I volunteered to represent Mrs. N on a pro bono basis, as the immigration attorneys in the Twin Cities had been and continue to be overwhelmed by an unprecedented surge in federal immigration enforcement. In the 41 hours following her arrest, Mrs. N was transferred between three different facilities, two in Minnesota and finally a horrendous detention center in Texas. I filed a habeas corpus petition. After substantial briefing and 23 days in custody, it was granted. The court stated it was disturbed by the facts of this case and specifically noted that her arrest, as children and their parents dropping them off at daycare looked on, was unlawful. 24 days after her unlawful arrest, she was released. 24 days without her husband, without her children, without being able to work to support her family. And it was 24 days that our community was missing a vital member of its staff, and 24 days that children who witnessed her arrest were left wondering whether she was safe and whether their school was safe. Child care centers should be places where families feel secure leaving their children each morning. They should be places where staff feel safe and able to care for the children. No child should witness an armed immigration arrest outside their school. Legislation like this is critical to ensuring that child care centers remain places of safety, stability, and trust for Minnesota's families. For these reasons, I strongly urge your support for this legislation and welcome any questions. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your story. Next, Mr. Zimmer is not joining us at this point in time. Next, we will have Audrey McCann, followed by Joey Dobson. Once you're settled at the testifiers table, you can go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Audrey McCann of South Minneapolis, where I am a legal observer at schools and daycares. I'm also a director of Children and Family Ministries in Northfield, and I'm here to speak in support of HF 3415. This proposed bill simply puts protections in place that used to exist at the federal level before Inauguration Day in 2025. It essentially calls for a return to previous DHS policy regarding protected areas. Among these protected areas were the same child care facilities this bill addresses. Children already show signs of trauma in response to Operation Metro Surge and the continued presence of federal agents in Minnesota. Children at church approach me with concerns about ICE, completely out of the blue, a sign that it is always in the back of their minds. Parents report an uptick in tantrums from small children who are unable to express or even process their fear and anxiety. A neighbor's concerned toddler begged their mother for a whistle by miming blowing one because they were too young to even know the word. On January 7th, hours before Renee Good was killed, a parent reached out to neighbors to keep watch at their child's Spanish immersion daycare center. Only an hour prior, a teacher had been taken by agents while children were present. Volunteers, including myself, committed to keeping watch every day thereafter, and as I give this testimony, there are volunteers keeping watch now. Community members, including brave toddlers, should not viscerally feel the duty to provide protection for child care centers. The responsibility for their protection falls on our elected leaders. This legislature is obligated to ensure Minnesotan children have the basic legal protection this bill offers. Thank you for taking seriously the committee's role as public servants.
Thank you for your time today. Next, we have Joey Dobson, who will be followed by John Fanning.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and members. My name is Joey Dobson. My baby attends a Spanish immersion school in South Minneapolis. I'm here to ask you, to beg you, to stand with us and to stand with our community. Our school is like many others these days. The break room is now a food pantry. Parents skip dinners and bedtimes to drive teachers home safe. And we patrol, putting our bodies in between harm and our beloved teachers. Early on in our patrol days, I was out with a fellow parent, laughing about how we know nothing about cars. Pretty sure all I know is my car is blue. And then we heard loud, repeated honking. A convoy of agents in big, bright SUVs racing down the street in front of the school with commuters following behind to alert the community. I pulled out my phone, hit record, and blew my whistle. With my back to the daycare door, we watched until we were sure they were gone. Staff had gathered in the lobby. I cannot describe the fear on their faces. We let them know when ICE was gone. Just a few minutes later, still standing patrol by the front door, I heard sirens. This time, a helper, a fire truck. A teacher was having a medical emergency induced by the stress of knowing ICE was nearby. She was taken away on a stretcher. The next week, I was driving a teacher home, connected to a rapid response signal channel with memorized directions to not be traced. We pulled up to her street. Sigue, she said. Don't stop. So I drove. There was a truck outside our house, the same kind that had taken her neighbor the day before. We drove until it was safe for her to walk through her own front door. And then it happened. A staff person from our school was abducted along with family members. So we keep standing outside in the cold, in the rain, as agitators drive by and yell obscenities, as plainclothes officers take our pictures. Last week, I asked my baby's teacher if they still want us out there patrolling.
Oh, yes, please, she said. We love your children, but it's so hard these days to have to smile, sing, and laugh with them, with all the fear we are holding. Knowing you are outside makes it all a little easier. Our schools are places of love and learning, toddler giggles, and so many snotty noses. But the last few months, the people who hold our babies have also held trauma and fear. Please use the power you have to protect our beloved community. Please support this bill.
Thank you for sharing your testimony. Finally, we have John Fanning. You can approach the table and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, co-chairs and members of the committee. I am John Fanning, Director of Education Partnerships Coalition of Minnesota, EPC, speaking in support of House File 3415. EPC is a bipartisan coalition of 9 cradle-to-career partnerships across Minnesota. Our collective impact model engages more than 600 partner organizations that are supporting more than 300,000 young Minnesotans and their families. EPC communities are in greater Minnesota as well as metro and urban parts of our great state, and we take our bipartisan stance very seriously, coming together across communities red and purple and blue in support of young Minnesotans and families who, of course, deserve nothing less than our bipartisan support. You've heard in other testimony that sensitive locations designations were afforded to daycares for decades before last year. You've heard in other testimony the consequences of the revocation of that designation that is every bit as predictable as it is tragic. What I hope my testimony can add today is to help you see the geographic, cultural, social, and political diversity across our state that is in support of this bill. As EPC, we come from Minneapolis and St. Paul. We also come from the West Metro, rooted mostly in Hopkins and St. Louis Park. We come from Rochester and Olmsted County. We come from Red Wing and Goodhue County. We come from St. Cloud and Stearns County, Northfield, Faribault and Rice County, and Austin and Mower County. Our work is locally decided and community driven. When I am here before you today, I am here because each of our EPC leaders got the approval of their boards of directors, their leadership tables, their community action networks, and their partners to have me here in support of this bill. This bill is critical to the safety of our young people and our families and the people who care for them. Thank you. Please support this bill.
Thank you for your testimony on behalf of your partners, Mr. Fanning. All right. Members, that concludes public testimony. We have an amendment to the DE, which is the A2 amendment. Representative Perez Vega, would you like to speak to the A2?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Let me scoot down closer to this microphone. This A2 amendment is in regards to changing the terms for child care center to also be inclusive to child care facility, which would include family child care providers and child care centers that are in places of worship. And I would like to move forward with that definition in this A2 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Perez Vega. Representative Sensenmayer, would you like to speak to the
A2? Thank you, Representative Perez Vega, and thank you for bringing this important announcement. We know that the people that open up their homes or their places of worship to our kids also deserve the same level of safety, and so I would encourage a yes vote on this amendment. Thank you.
Co-Chair West.
So with this expanded definition, would that mean that people are unable to consent to someone coming into their home if they were a family child care provider?
Representative Perez Vega?
During the hours of work hours, yes.
Chair West?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Perez Vega. right now, a family already has the ability to, under the Fourth Amendment, I'm sure we're going to see a lot of suits to that effect, to deny access based on an administrative warrant. Not taking away their ability to consent to access of a federal immigration agent, like to their own homes, private property, seems like an overstretch. Because as the ACLU attorney mentioned, this strikes the consent of the property owner slash, and in this case, the homeowner. And that seems like an unfortunate expansion that's well beyond what is, well, I mean, I don't even, that just seems crazy that you can't consent from your own home. So this amendment, I would urge members not to support.
Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. It seems quite of a bit of stretch to actually not put value into all the testimony that we've heard today. And as a proud member of this committee, as a proud mother who has to be waking up tonight, not to in the middle of the night, for my daughter to have nightmares because this is the realities that we have in our communities. And I think back to my child care, which was in-home child care by my grandmother, may she rest in peace, a Puerto Rican woman from the mountains of Puerto Rico, where our fabulous Bad Bunny of a halftime show comes from, who was born before Puerto Ricans were granted statutory citizenship. She was born a year before that. And I think about how when she applauded to being able to vote for president because she moved to Minnesota, where I was born and able to take care of children for the entirety of as she could in her home, and also influence the child care providers that are in my district, like Sandra Rosario in a child fun and play child care center that is one of the constituents that fears for the safety of our children. Not just within our district in the community of West Side, a proud immigrant community known as the Ellis Island of Minnesota in the late 1800s. Calling it a stretch, I think calling a stretch that federal agents get to wear masks and run into these facilities without even showing a judicial warrant should be held account as to how we are growing a future for Minnesota children, for Minnesota parents, grandparents, child care providers, the trauma that has come into this. And I know my job here is to listen to my constituents and work for them. And I work for them on both sides of the aisle. And when I can get folks who aren't looking at politicizing their children and their workforce, but asking us to come together to protect wherever their child care is why I'm asking and urging members to vote yes. Thank you.
Any further discussion to the Representative Nadeau?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you,
Representative. Oh, what? I always forget to turn that on. I talk loud enough. And thank you. I'm a no vote on this amendment, but I wanted to explain why, because I think you're going in the right direction that I think some of us want to go. I'm probably going to be a no vote on the underlying bill, and I'm going to explain it all at once. And I'm going to make a motion at some point, Madam Chair, to table this, because I think there are people that want this to happen, but there's some significant concerns, and I'll address the A2 first. You know, by extending this into homes, into private places, you know, already, you know, ICE, any law enforcement agency needs consent to enter non-public areas without a judicial warrant. So it adds some complexity to this. And then there's people like me that say, wait a second, what about hospitals? What about group homes? And so I'll just do it all now and then I won't talk again. But I think that we need to look at, you know, according to the Supremacy Clause, and it was also doubled down in Arizona versus United States in 2025 when Arizona tried to take over immigration action from the federal government. They were struck down. We can't do this. No matter what we want, we can't. But what came out of that was states can set neutral property access rules, and then they can designate certain areas as non-public restricted areas. And I think if we go that path and list those things, I think we can get there and not feel like we're violating the Supremacy Clause, because that's where I feel like I am today. And with that, I'm going to vote no on the A2, and at the appropriate time, I'm going to ask to table this bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Doe. Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Once again, I urge a yes vote for the future of the behavioral health of our children, for the workforce environment, for our child care providers, and the safety of the net for what is a child care facility, whether it is in a public or private space. Gracias.
Representative Sensenmira, any last words?
I just want to say that, Representative Nadeau, if you want to bring a bill that is keeping ICE out of all sensitive spaces, hospitals, group homes, schools, child care centers, I would certainly sign on. I think there are probably some other colleagues. I would love to be number two on that bill. So thank you for bringing that up.
All right. Members, we are going to move to a vote on the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
All right. The motion fails. And the A2 amendment is not adopted, as we require a majority of members of the committee, which would be 8 votes to pass. All right. So to the bill as amended, members, we will open it up for discussion. Nelson, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Katiza-Watun, and thank you for this bill. And I want to thank the testifiers. I think in so many ways, you know, it's several of us on this side here are rural, and we haven't seen the same. It's been a different reality than you have lived, and I want to acknowledge that, and it is very different. And at the same time, we have disruptions in our community too, and we have seen that. And it's, you know, so much of what has happened in the last 6 weeks, or you know, maybe a little bit over that, is not been what we have known to be for Americans. This is not the America that, you know, we grew up in. Probably many of you, and so it's been difficult to see that. And you know, I've seen it on the news, where many of you have seen it firsthand. Your children have seen it, and I'm sorry for that. That's something that, you know, I don't know what as a child to see that and the memories that will take. I don't. That's something we can't take lightly, and I feel for them. And I, as I look at this bill, I do have a question on it, as on, or the DE, the line 1.16, is talking about an employee of a child care center must not consent to federal officials coming in, and unless there's a warrant or whatever. But I'm wondering. I know what the idea of this policy is. It's to stop ICE from coming in to it. But I worry that putting that when you look at if they come in, is the immigration enforcement, is that the ones that are breaking the law? Because as I read this policy, I see it as the employees are the ones that is, unfortunately, the action comes against them. Because if they, you know, I don't, and you know, that's talking about the consent of it, you know, so they cannot consent to that. So that's, but if somebody does that, if an employee wrongly consents to this, is that employee in the one that's in violation, or is it the ICE agents?
Representative
Sensenmira.
Yeah, thank you, Vice Chair Nelson, for that question, and I'll answer, and then I would maybe nonpartisan can also give a response, or also I believe that John Buehler from the ACLU could maybe give some context. You know, I think about what I have heard from child care centers, schools, hospitals, all of these sensitive spaces, is that they want really clear guidance from us about what they should do, and they want to be able to stand behind Minnesota law by saying, do not come in here unless you have a judicial warrant. So I think part of this is trying to give that clarity about where Minnesota stands on this so that the workers or the child care owners can state that law and, you know, not let someone in without a judicial warrant. But I will turn it over to my testifier.
Mr. Buehler.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Nelson. As we've mentioned many times across many committees, the supremacy clause does prevent us from regulating federal agents directly. What we can do here is we can tell our state employees, or we can tell employees that work in regulated industries like daycare, what they can and cannot do. And so, yes, this does place the regulations on the daycares and the daycare employees and tells them that they do not have the authority to consent to civil immigration enforcement on their facilities.
Vice Chair Nelson, follow up.
Thank you, Chair Katiza-Watun. And so maybe if you could follow up, as I understood your answer, if that it really ends up putting the burden on the employee of the center then instead of, and so there's no enforcement action on, you know, penalties or anything like that in here, but is the policy of what you're trying to do is to make sure that they're not entering a child care. But is this policy inadvertently putting the pressure on the daycare or on the child care center? I'm concerned that it's going in the wrong, that the policy ends up going in the wrong direction of what, because it's putting on the burden on the wrong individual if I'm reading this correctly. And maybe I'm misunderstanding it, so I don't know if you want to try again or if nonpartisan wants to or where this is, but
Mr. Buehler,
thank you, Chair. Representative
Buehler,
Nelson.
John Buehler.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Nelson. We don't necessarily see it as a burden. I see it as clarity for the daycare facilities and their workers that they need to say, do you have a warrant? That it gives them that clarity for when these masked agents come to their door to say, do you have a warrant? You are allowed access for the areas of our facility that are listed on the warrant and access to the people listed on the warrant.
Representative Sensenmira.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And just to kind of give further response, Vice Chair Nelson, you know, we did hear a support of this bill from child care owners today, from child care organizations. I think they are asking for this clarity. They are asking for this guidance. You know, and I think certainly I wish that this was still federal policy and so we didn't have to do this at the state level. There's a reason why we don't have this in our state statute. It's because we didn't need it. And so any advocacy that any of us can do, I would love it if the Children and Families Committee would write a letter to the federal government asking them to go back to the policy that we all agreed on for decades. I think that that would be a good use of this committee's time and power.
Mr. Buehler.
And thank you. That did remind me, Chair. It applies to both federal officers, state and local officers. And what we've seen here in Minnesota is an ongoing expansion of these local federal partnerships in immigration, civil immigration enforcement. So we do have the right under this to restrict civil and local law enforcement from doing that. We don't have the right, as we've talked about, to restrict federal law enforcement, but it does place additional burdens on some.
Vice Chair Nelson.
And thank you for that, Chair Katiza-Watun, and I'm looking at this, and I thank you for your answer, but I'm still unclear if an employee allows it, because I know we've heard from child care providers that they want clarification, and I understand that, and I appreciate that. I'm still not understanding this. If they were to consent, they are the ones breaking the law. Is that correct?
Representative Sensenmira.
Yes.
Okay.
Vice Chair Nelson.
And so I want to be clear that if the child care facility is the one that, if they were to consent, I know it gives some clarity, but it also, it puts, I think it unfortunately puts them in a bad situation too. If there was an employee that misunderstood the warrant or whatever, they could be allowing somebody in that is on the incorrect warrant or whatever, assuming they're doing the right thing, but inadvertently end up breaking the law doing this. And so I understand what this is trying to do, but I think unfortunately it ends up putting the burden on the care facility instead of really clarifying what the facilities can do.
And Representative Sensabria, you may have done this by design when you didn't include any sort of enforcement mechanism, so that, you know, even if an employee were to inadvertently allow somebody in or consent to entry, but I think what Vice Chair Nelson might be asking is what happens then?
Yes, thank you, Chair Keyes-Rotun. So as I understand it, then they could be opening themselves up for civil litigation. And I think, you know, we can keep talking about that. We want to protect childcare workers. We want to check childcare facilities. I'm happy to hear that my Republican colleagues are in agreement about the spirit of the bill. That gives me some hope that we could move forward. But I know, I think as we discussed, because we could not make laws about what the federal government can do, our hands are a little tied here, and I absolutely believe we need to do something.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill, and thank you, all of you, every single one of you who stood outside and protected kids. Thank you. So I first want to just say, I want a clarification. Where is this going if we pass it?
Representative Hicks, the motion is to send it to the General Register.
Okay. So if we sent it to the General Register, Representative Sensomura, would you be open to an amendment that maybe added some, like, good faith language in so that if it was an accident, people would be protected? Would you be open to a floor amendment of that kind?
Representative Sensomura.
I would want to look into that more, but definitely open to conversations.
Great. Thank you. Hicks. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. I appreciate that because I do think, you know, sometimes in a lot of the committees that I'm in, frankly, we end up having so many weedy conversations that we don't do anything. We just stop moving things forward because we're stuck on a word or we're stuck on an unintentional consequence. And this isn't the floor vote. There is an opportunity to take this and do more with it. And I have had several conversations with many people who have shared what Vice Chair Nelson shared, that, like, that's just not what they've seen in their community. And so what I'm asking today from our colleagues across the table is to trust the people who have seen it, the folks who came before you and said this is what's happening in our community, and vote yes to move it forward to the floor. And if there are technical concerns and good faith concerns, I think we can work on that, and we can have those conversations as floor amendments, and we can have a deeper discussion. But when we continue to, and I say collective we, because it happens in all committees, both sides of the table, right? But when we continue to not listen to community and do nothing because we have technical concerns, we do nothing. And in my personal opinion, doing nothing is an active choice, and it is a choice that we can make. But in my opinion, in my life, typically, it's a bad choice to do nothing. And so today I will be a yes, because I'm going to vote to do something. So thank you for bringing this.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not going to take this chance to insult anyone's personalities or their integrity or their character, as we saw in past committees. I will consider at the conclusion of my talk here that matter or that event is over, and we will not open that box again.
Representative Olson.
Now, with that being said, I got real concerns with this bill in itself.
Excuse me.
Yes, Madam Chair.
I believe that you are calling into question my...
That was never stated, Madam Chair.
Interesting. That was what was insinuated, Mr. Olson. You may proceed.
It's a great interpretation, Madam Chair. Now, my biggest concern falls very closely along Representative Nelson's issues here. Now, when we're talking about clarity for these child caregivers, these child care facilities, these people who watch our children, what more clarity is there than the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America? The one that says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. It talks about warrants. This is, I believe, as Representative Hicks said, I believe these stories. But I don't believe that making this onus on our child caregivers is the right answer. Opening them up to civil problems, civil suits, that's not the answer. There could, in fact, be an answer. I think the answer is the Fourth Amendment, and I think that this brief that we received of the Children's Defense Fund, Minnesota, in support of plaintiffs' motions for preliminary injunction, this is the judicial system doing its job. I think that that's an answer. But I am very concerned about the concept of putting the onus on these individuals, asking these child care givers, these people who watch our children, to stand like Gandalf in the gap and say, "You shall not pass." That's concerning to me. They already know that that's their right. That is their right as an American, that the Fourth Amendment spells it out. The Fourth Amendment does not provide them the opportunity to have civil litigation against them. The Fourth Amendment will not cause them to lose their property, will not cause them to lose their livelihoods. That is the biggest concern that we should have here. And work is done in committee. Work is not done on the floor. Many individuals in this area will say that the floor is where the theater happens and the work happens in committee. This shall not leave committee without being fixed. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. In early January, a man dressed in a suit much like Representative Olson's approached a daycare center in my community. He piggybacked into the center on another parent who looked at him and how he was dressed and assumed he was a father, also similarly there to maybe pick up his child like she was. The man walked into the daycare and he grabbed a worker and he took her out like a woman's worst nightmare come true, kicking and screaming in broad daylight. And when people tried to stop him, he said, "I'm ICE, I'm ICE, I'm ICE. I have the right to do this." She is a citizen. So I wish the Fourth Amendment worked. I really wish the Constitution worked. And I really wish we could count on it. It's actually just devastating and a travesty to see this. You know, daycares around my community, and I'm in the suburbs, right? And I want to remind folks of that. Like, I think we hear a lot of folks about ICE in the cities, and suburbanites are kind of have a habit of maybe saying, "Well, that happened to them and not us," and it kind of us is and them's the one state that we are. But I am in the burbs, and we were one of the most targeted suburbs in the entire state of Minnesota. And we are, it started on December 8th, and it hasn't stopped. We've had upwards of some days 200 incidents logged a day. Other days, obviously fewer. But you know, the observers ran on 12 to 18 hour shifts, 7 days a week, to keep an eye on our neighbors. And we have a thriving immigrant community. And so not only at the daycares, you know, did the Fourth Amendment not work, but I think I'd shared the story before in another committee that, you know, a man pulled up to get groceries at the local Mercado, and ICE approached his car, again, plain clothes, no suit, no identifying anything, and smashed his window and took him while he had two little ones at home and was grieving the loss of his wife who had just passed away. He had all the valid right documentation. He was doing everything right. Another time, a six-year-old boy was getting off the bus. His dad was waiting for him, just literally catty corner from my neighborhood, and he went to run to his dad, and ICE grabbed him, again, plain clothes. They grabbed him, and this little boy looked around, and there was moms, is what he saw, but strangers. Nobody knew who he was. We called the police, and the police refused to help us find where this child was supposed to go, which is a problem in and of itself, which we are addressing. But, you know, this little boy was with strangers for 4 hours before somebody drove by that we knew, and she says, "Oh, I know who his family is," right? So I think there's a lot of things to say that, you know, our children are absolutely being affected by this, and they're absolutely going through a lot. And I wish that the Constitution protected my children the way that it protected my childhood. I wish that was something I could say. You know, I have friends and neighbors and constituents who fled civil wars, people who fought in the secret war who came here, people who fought in wars that we don't talk about, from genocides we don't talk about, that came here, that have faced things I could never imagine, and most people in this room could probably never imagine. And so when I saw them having to face off with this again in my community, it was awful. And I think the hardest part was at the child care centers. And watching people stand alongside, even knowing that they were at risk of being taken, it was worth it to protect their children from ending up in a family detention center in Texas, which is terrifying. Madam Chair, I would like a roll call on this vote, please.
Roll call being requested. There will be a roll call.
Thank you. So thank you for doing this. And I agree that maybe there's other better ways we can do it. I think that's the beauty of being a policymaker, is that we get to come across the aisle, put our heads together, and figure out a way that we use our humanity together to do the right thing. I would like to do that with anybody who's willing. If you need to hear stories that, you're soft to the stories of those in the suburbs, you know, feel free to ask. I have hundreds that I could share with you from what I witnessed. And I'm realizing as I've been talking about this and as we've been talking about in the legislature that, the trauma is real even for me. Like, I kind of have like a blacked out memory from the last couple of months, feeling the sobs of women just crying against my chest because their husbands were taken. Like, I can't unfeel that. One woman cried on my shoulder and it was cold outside and my shirt was wet. I walked out and the wind hit it and it was freezing. And on my shoulder, I cannot unfeel that. Children screaming, calling me as their parents were being taken, begging for help. If you've never heard a child who was screaming for their life, it's something I wake up in cold sweats to this moment. And I bet a lot of people in this room are experiencing that too, or are helping somebody who is. So thank you for doing this. This is hard work. And I think it takes the heart of real Minnesotans, real people, rooted in who we are as a community to do this work. So I hope that the words here were not hollow, and I hope we can really find some solutions and some things we can do so no one has to face this again. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Hansen. Next. He's going to go left. She's going to go left. Okay. Representative Perez Vega, did you have a closing comment?
Thank you. It's Representative Sensor Mura for bringing this, and I'm proud to co-author. We've been moms to little ones. I'm going almost on 7 years since we were fellows at Wilder together, and I just am baffled to think that this is the realities of our consistent conversations of how are we raising our children in a world like this. And we've heard that from everyone, and I just want to thank you all. I've seen y'all on the front lines. What a privilege, Representative Nelson, that you have, that this isn't your reality every day. I look forward to working on legislation so that this isn't the Minnesota that our kids say has gone a sinkhole. I want everyone to connect that we're not here expressing our pains to be ignored. You're hearing the echoes of trauma. I worked at a child care center on Nicollet Avenue in 2011. Came in as a volunteer. And to think that that is on 18th and Nicollet, and you think about where my father's nurse at the VA was murdered in broad daylight off of Eat Street, which is now called Elm Street to an extent to our communities. What a privilege it is, Representative, that you have, that this isn't what you've witnessed, what your children have witnessed. Violence. Heck, I want our Constitution to be followed. But what happens when the Constitution isn't being followed for the most vulnerable people in our state, in our country, which is our children? So if I urge folks to find morality and humanity right now. And this committee is one of the most important committees in the sectors of policy because we care about the well-being of our future, from our littlest to our age wellness. Nothing's right with ignoring the realities of all those who gave testimony and who are not here, who are scared to give their testimony right now. Please vote yes.
Chair West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to quick condense everything I'm going to say. So what we've seen is it seems like this bill doesn't provide clarity because it appears that the perception is it's going to stop federal immigration in some way. And striking the ability to consent doesn't do that. Like, it does not hinder ICE in any way. So we could pass this bill, but it would make literally no difference. It just, we shouldn't be focused on things like that. We should be focused on helping all Minnesotans, whether it's affording daycare or making it more safe or helping our foster system. That's what this committee is for. This is a political issue that needs to be dealt with at the federal level because we are fundamentally incapable of dealing with it. So I'd urge members not to support the bill. The question I have really quick is, so you mentioned so it's a civil recourse. So say the property owner consents, they have an employee who is who opposed and reports them. Do they call the police and the police can then intervene because it's a violation of the law? And then how do they prove, I'm assuming civil case, they need to prove damages? Or how would that work, the second part of that, if this were to be law?
Representative Mr. Beeler, very briefly.
Thank you, Chair Kizutun, Co-Chair West. I am unfamiliar. I'd have to kick it to House Research on this because I don't know what violations of this chapter lead to. I don't believe there are criminal charges, so no, I don't believe police involvement would be there. But I do not know if there is a default civil cause of action for violation of this chapter.
Chair West, is it okay if we follow up with this offline?
That's fine.
Thank you. Representative Sensenmira, I'm going to give you last words on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Co-Chair West, and members of the committee. You know, it's hard because, and I think you can feel from the passion and the energy in this room, like our community really does feel like with the consent of your party, like a war was sent to our community. And it feels strange now to have to sit here in committee and try to write laws that say, hey, next time you do a war on our community, please be a little less bad. Please, you know, can we all just agree that next time don't come after the kids? I don't want to do that. I don't think this is the strongest law. I want to have a different federal government. But in the meantime, I have to use the tools that I have here to stand up for my community. You know, so I'll just say I'm thinking as we end today about two words. One of them is precarious. And I think about that word because I think all the time in this committee we hear that our childcare system is precarious. It is about to topple over. It is about to break. Our childcare workers are about to break because we ask them to do too much with too few wages. Our childcare owners are about to break because they are asked to do attendance and billing and figure out how many diapers they need. And now we're also asking them to do patrol and to think about on their way to work whether or not their employees are going to get picked up. I think about how precarious it is to be a parent of young kids, and like it is already so hard. And you're so tired all the time, and childcare is so expensive. And now you have to take time off work to be out in your community, and you have to be figuring out how to explain to your kids why you have to wear a vest at the same time that you're trying to make it seem like everything is just okay and it just kind of is part of the game. And then the other word that I'm thinking about is precious, and that childhood is precious, and that if our kids are lucky, they are going to get one childhood and this is it, and that the kids in our community are going to be forever tainted and changed by what has happened. You know, there's this popular show, Daniel Tiger, and they have this song that's grown-ups come always come back, right? And it's like, there has to be a song in a children's show because that is so scary to kids, that the idea that grown-ups in their life might not come back. And there are children of my community who now have a real fear, like their grown-up might not come back. Is their parent going to be able to pick them up at the end of the day? Is the worker that they care about that rubs their back during nap time going to be there? We as a society have forever tainted these kids. And so, I will do everything in my power, even if it isn't perfect, to try to protect our kids moving forward. I'm happy to hear that we agree with the spirit of keeping ICE out of child care centers. I'm happy to continue to try to talk about how to do something around this issue. Thank you.
The clerk will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Chair West?
No.
Vice Chair Hansen?
Yes.
Vice Chair Nelson?
No.
Representative Altendorf?
No.
Representative Coulter?
Aye.
Representative Hicks?
Aye.
Representative Lee?
Yes.
Representative McDonald?
Aye.
Representative Nadeau?
No.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Perez Vega?
C, yes.
Representative Sensormira?
Yes.
Representative Zeleznikar? Sorry.
With a vote of 7 ayes and 6 noes, the bill does not pass. Representative Sensormira, still in the jurisdiction of this committee. We're running long on time again. I want to thank all of our testifiers for joining us today, and I'd like to remind us all that the only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. And you can bet your bottom dollar that the House DFL is not going to do nothing. With that, we are adjourned.